Paris, October 1922. Paris was soon behind them. Catherine sat very still and withdrawn, her eyes fixed on the window as the train rattled past the shabby little houses of the Bagneux with their gray cabbage plots, brightened here and there by yellow bursts of chrysanthemums, then on across charred fields where peasants were burning off the wheat stubble. In the distance, up ahead, lay the forest of Fontainebleau, a dark streak on the horizon. On the seat beside her lay a pair of dove-gray gloves and a wilted bouquet of cyclamen Ida had insisted on buying for her from a beggar girl at the Gare de Lyon. At her feet, her leather valise containing only the essentials for an overnight trip. Her hat box and steamer trunk had been left behind at the Select Hotel, for she had been invited to spend only one night in Fontainebleau at G.I. Gurdjieff's Institute for the Harmonious Development of Man. If Mr. Gurdjieff accepted her as a pupil and allowed her to stay, she would send Ida back to Paris early in the morning to fetch her trunk and other belongings. The question was, would he say yes? And would he let her stay for as long as 3 months? That ought to be enough, she thought. Though enough for what, exactly, she was not sure. Ida sat across from her, looking distraught, puzzling over a handful of coins, counting and recounting francs and sous. This journey, like so many others, would have been impossible without her assistance, and Catherine knew she should be grateful. Yet Ida's every awkward gesture, every little blunder, jarred her nerves. She watched Ida fumbling in her pockets, pulling out more change. The train jolted. A 5-franc piece tumbled from her hand, rolled across the floor, and slipped before their eyes into a niche beneath a seat where it was now quite irretrievable. "Oh, Katie, look what I've done. That was just what we needed to pay our cab fare." Catherine shrugged and said nothing. Her dependence on Ida was one of those chains from which, she hoped, she would soon be freed. A ray of sun flashed on the gleaming brass nameplate of her valise. Catherine stared at the engraved letters KMM for Catherine Mansfield Murray. That was not the name printed on the passport she carried in the vest pocket of her overcoat, which was her real name, Kathleen Beauchamp Murray. But those were only two of a multitude. Kathleen, Catherine, Kath, Katie, Kathy, Katya, Yekaterina, Kass, Kisinka, K.M., Tig. She had a host of names ready for any occasion, and each one conjured up a different woman. Lately she had begun to wonder which, if any, of these characters was the real I. "Your name is Legion," Uspensky had said. Who was she really? Only a nameless pair of eyes, she often thought, absorbing the world into a pitiless gaze. To this thought she had returned often over the last few weeks. I have been a camera, a mere mechanical observer. At times it seemed to her she could even detach herself from her own body as it jerked and coughed like a mechanical doll, while another eye looked down upon her from above, gilding all with a light from elsewhere. Was that perhaps the inner light of self Gurdjieff promised to awaken? Now the train skirted a dense wood. It was a golden afternoon. The woods were full of people out walking on pathways, thickly carpeted with dead leaves. A fellow roaming with two ginger-colored hunting dogs waved at the train as it passed. "When does a journey really begin?" thought Catherine, as the man with the dogs met her eyes, then slid away in the window. It was a little like falling in love or running into debt. The beginning is so subtle you may not notice, then suddenly there you are hurtling into the distance on a train, and there's no turning back until you reach the end of the line, until you have gone all the way through with it, burning your bridges if need be, and leaving everything tidy in case you never make it back. She always did that before a journey, answered every letter, paid every bill, destroyed every useless or embarrassing scrap of paper. Last August, she had gone so far as to make her will, naming Murray executor, and leaving her cherished pearl ring to his younger brother, to Ida, her gold watch. She had no other valuables to dispose of. She had accumulated little in 34 years. A brass pig, a walking stick, a broken Japanese doll, when she had once dreamed of owning houses, gardens, and an automobile. This short trip today would somehow be decisive. To think this journey had all begun by opening a book months ago in Switzerland. How bitterly she and Jack had quarreled over cosmic anatomy. But reading that book had struck a low note of recognition in her, like the sound of a foghorn in the bay, signaling the presence of something portentous, moving in the darkness, intoning a warning, "Wake up! Do something! There isn't much time!" And here she was, doing it, whatever it was, whatever it meant. By the time she had stepped through the doors of 38 Warwick Gardens to hear Uspensky speak, she was already midway to Fontainebleau. The train lurched as they approached the station. She glanced at the objects surrounding her, the leather valise, the dove-gray gloves, the tired cyclamen, the maroon suede shoes on her small feet. She considered herself among these possessions. A woman, traveling by train, her bag stuffed with cigarettes, pills for headaches and rheumatism, laundry lists, pencil stubs, notepads, a blood-spotted handkerchief, a rapidly depleting supply of French francs, and a small traveling clock, ticking the minutes away. Now she considered Ida sitting across from her, peeling an orange and slipping the peels into her pocket, for there was nowhere else to put them except under the seat, and offering her an orange segment, which she refused. Dear, dull, dreamy Ida, with her red nose and dumpy bosom, her chubby calves and puzzled eyes, once so lovely, with blonde hair hanging to her waist like a hank of silk. Ida, her jailer, her slave, her shame, and yes, Ida, her sole relief. Catherine could hardly bear to look at her at times, overcome by disgust with herself, at crushing Ida so completely. Disgust, too, at Ida's willing submission. Fury at her own need for Ida's coddling and care. That dreadful winter in Ospedaletti, she had positively hated Ida for doing what Murray refused to do or never even thought of doing. Yet she could never have written 10 words over the last 4 years if Ida had not been there to make the tea, boil the eggs, rush back and forth with hot water bottles, however tepid, and keep her supplied with stamps and milk and bread while she lay wrapped in blankets on the sofa or on a chaise longue, scribbling in her notebook. None of her recent work, which she judged to be her best, could ever have been completed without Ida's help, and she knew that Ida understood this. It was Ida's secret triumph. It was her reward. Through it all, Ida had been the perfect friend. Where would she be today without Ida? She could not climb stairs unassisted, and there were days when she could not walk at all. Strangers thrust chairs at her when she stepped breathless into a shop. Old women offered her their arms on street corners. It was appalling to be so ill, to be so dependent. She often wondered what her relationship with Ida would have been like had she not fallen ill. Might they have had a cooler, more civil friendship conducted at a distance? Would Ida have married Robert Gibson, returning to Rhodesia to have a brood of children? Would she and Murray have played doting aunt and uncle for Ida's gangly, sunburnt bairns? Impossible to imagine, though it was a great loss that neither one of them had experienced motherhood. No one, not even Murray, understood their special friendship. It secretly amused and pleased her that no one seemed to see that Ida's devotion was by no means one-sided. They were like an old married couple, perfectly matched in their defects and idiosyncrasies, bound fast by habit, but also by a tough affection that nothing could erode. Ida was more than nurse, secretary, wife. In some very peculiar way, Ida was Catherine, just as she was Ida. That was the miracle. But how would Ida adapt now the time had come for her to turn away?